Welcome to this 11KBW podcast. I'm Peters V. Haringey, GPOC and Commercial Purposes by Daniel Eisenberg. This talk was given at the 11KBW Local Authority Conference on the 27th of September 2018 at the Turing Lecture Theatre in London. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
So as you can see, my talk is entitled Peters and Haringey, GPOC and Commercial Purposes. It's not about three things, it's really about one thing. That's namely the Peters and Haringey case. I'm going to focus quite specifically on the commercial purposes principle, and if there's time, also touch upon the consultation duty. So just a bit of background to the case. The claimant, Mr. Peters, was a resident of Haringey, and he was a member of a local group, Stop HDV. HDV was the Haringey Development Vehicle, which was set up between the local authority and the interested party, Lendlease Europe, which was a private commercial entity for the purposes of property development within Haringey. Claim, as you can see, issued in August 2017, subsequent rolled-up hearing in October, and the judgment in February this year. Spoiler alert, permission was refused on all grounds. I understand the claimant has made an application for permission to appeal. Circumstances may have been kind of overtaken by the local elections, but for the purposes of the talk and the law, the case remains good law. So four grounds of challenge were brought. I'm going to focus primarily on the first one, which was the decision to participate in the LLP. So the relationship between the local authority and the private entity Lendlease, they came together, formed an LLP, and the claimant said that this was ultra vires because for the reasons of the commercial purposes of the enterprise, the local authority was obliged to do this through a company rather than through an LLP. As you can see, this claim failed, and we'll get into the kind of meat and gravy of it shortly. The second aspect of the claim, which I'd also like to touch upon, is the consultation duty under Section 3.2 of the Local Government Act 1999. That's to do with the best value duty. And then there were two other grounds of challenge, which I won't focus on, the PSCD challenge. As Andrew's already forecast, it's almost difficult to find a claim without a PSCD challenge these days. And also a more procedural challenge as to whether the decision should have been taken by full counsel rather than just the executive. Again, that failed. So the general background to this, really, the kind of meat of the claim, is the commercial purpose provision in the Section 4 of the Localism Act 2011. So just to consider the statutory framework here, Section 1 is the general power of competence, GPOC, as we know it. And Section 4 creates what one wouldn't call a full exception, but some provisos with regard to when the authority is acting for a commercial purpose. The relevance to the Peters and Haringey case, it's really about Section 4.2, which you can see on the slide. But just to give it slight statutory context, I'm just going to briefly touch upon Sections 4.1 and Sections 4.3 as well to kind of put it in its context. So Section 4.1 says that the general power under Section 1, that's the GPOC, confers power on a local authority to do things for a commercial purpose only if they are things which the authority may, in the exercise of the general power, do otherwise than for a commercial purpose. So essentially, the commercial purpose is no wider than the general power of competence under Section 1. So that's the general principle. And Section 3, the authority can't, in the exercise of the general power, do things for a commercial purpose, and this is the quote, in relation to a person if a statutory provision requires the authority to do those things in relation to the person. So you can't use the commercial purposes provision if you're already required to do something in relation to a person pursuant to statutory provision. So the broad framework here is you can do things for a commercial purpose, but one, under Section 4.1, it can't be for any reasons wider than the general power, the GPOC. And also, if you're required to do it under another statutory provision, you can't then do it for a commercial purpose. So those are Sections 4.1 and 4.3. And then in the middle of those two is Section 4.2, which is relevant to the Peters case, which is where in the exercise of the general power a local authority does things for a commercial purpose, it must do them through a company. This was the basis of the claim that the authority was acting through an LLP rather than through a company, and accordingly, the action was ultra vires. Now, one can understand why an authority may wish to do things through a company, not do things through a company, or do things through some other alternative vehicle. So, as you can see, sometimes it might be more sensible or preferable to act without a company, acting directly by the local authority. This might be some presentational issue, or it might be to do with the kind of control or governance that the authority wants to have over the relevant project. Alternatively, there might be some reasons, as in this case, why one wants to use an alternative structure, such as an LLP. And in Peters itself, there were valid tax reasons why the authority wanted to use an LLP, because both the authority and the private entity could enter into the LLP, divide the profits between them, and each would be taxed according to its own status. So I put some examples here of the kind of complexities that might arise in practice in relation to whether or not the commercial purposes provision applies. So you can see what I've described as the plain vanilla case. This is a case in which the local authority has established a trading venture solely to make money. So it's going to be for dealing with a profit. And it's obviously for a, you know, it's the money is intended to kind of generally to go back into the kitty. So I've called this a plain vanilla case. That seems to me one which would clearly be caught by Section 4. It's acting for a commercial purpose. But if we tweak any of those variables, suddenly we're in territory where it's not so clear whether or not Section 4 applies, whether it's a commercial purpose. And crucially, if it's no longer a commercial purpose, then the authority is no longer obliged to use a company, can use an LLP, or it could even act perhaps directly. So just four examples I've given. One will be in the situation where the activity will generate some profit, but will also be socially useful. So it'll create jobs, create development and service a need that's not met by the market. There's another scenario in which profit's desired, but actually really it's just a useful byproduct. Thirdly, the intention may not be to put profits back into the general kitty of the authority, but rather to recycle them just within that venture. Or finally, it might be where the terms of business appear commercial, but actually the rate of charging is either at kind of break-even or even loss-leading format, such that you might say it doesn't appear at least to be commercial. And the question is, will Section 4 bite in some of these non-vanilla circumstances? Which takes us to the actual reasoning in Peters. So in Peters, it was clear, oh, I think one of my microphones may not be working, that the LLP itself was set up to do business with a view to profit, and that's a requirement of an LLP generally. So we've got profit. The other company with which the authority was engaging, Lendlease, was a commercial entity. So that's engaging in the venture for profit. But the material profit from the development of the properties was expected, and the council was welcoming of the profit that would be generated. So on the face of it, you might take the view that this looks and feels like Section 4 might be engaged. We've got engaging with another private entity, which is looking for profit, recognition and welcome of the fact that profit is going to be increased as a consequence of the venture. However, and this is the crucial point, the council also saw the vehicle as either the best or the only means to use its lands to achieve the aims of regeneration, job creation, and building new houses. It kind of saw the engagement with a private sector company as a means of investment and attracting that investment from the private sector, combined with its own land assets to create regeneration and property development. And the claimant essentially had to concede that on the facts of this case, it was unable to show that money-making was the dominant purpose for the council. And that phrase, dominant purpose, we'll see, is an important one. So to get to the actual core of the holding of Mr. Justice Ouseley, ultimately, he found that the council was not acting for a commercial purpose. So notwithstanding the generation of profits and the engagement with a profit-seeking private company, nevertheless, this was not acting for commercial purposes, and accordingly, the council was entitled to act through an LLP. The first issue was, whose purpose are we looking at here? Are we looking at the purpose of HDV, the LLP that's been created, or the purpose of the council in entering into the LLP? And the judge held that the relevant decision here, the locus, is focusing on the action of the council, not looking at the purpose of the HDV. And in some ways, that's understandable because, kind of thinking about this in classic public law terms, the decision which has been impugned here is the decision of the council to enter into the LLP. So it meant nothing to the legal question here, the fact that the HDV itself was looking to make profit, or the motives of the private company, which was also engaged in the enterprise. So simply making profit, or intending to do so, was not enough to demonstrate commercial purpose. The question here was not whether the council was acting commercially, but whether it was acting for commercial purposes. So the court took a rather holistic view of what was going on here and said, is the council really acting here commercially or not? And it took the view that no, what was really going on here was a project for regeneration. Taking a step back, we can end up in what I see as two scenarios here, where the court is able to take a step back and look at a single purpose, an overall picture. It'll say, well, what is the purpose here? Is it commercial? Is it not commercial? And that's essentially what the court was able to do in Peters. If, however, the court is unable to say there's a single purpose here, but rather there are multiple purposes, that's when the court seems to be encouraged by Mr. Justice Ouseley in Peters to look for the dominant purpose. And that was the relevance earlier on of the claimant being unable to demonstrate that the dominant purpose here was commercial. So on the facts of Peters, the kind of council's single or the overall purpose was deemed non-commercial. It was regeneration rather than property development. And the commercial component was kind of ancillary to that. So thinking about the consequences of this. Firstly, the purpose here, as we can see from the judgment, is that purpose turns here on the motive of the authority rather than a mere kind of objective view of taking a step back and looking at all the facts. So we're looking here for what the authority's motive is. So from a practical perspective, the relevance here for authorities is to be crystal clear in planning a project such as this, to be on precisely the motives and the purposes of the project. If one wants to rely on the general power of competence for activities which are likely to have a profit element to them, one has to be very clear that the motive here isn't the commercial activity. It's something else within the GPOC. Accordingly, then, it doesn't necessarily matter if it's structured in a way which is going to bring financial advantage to the council, or to the authority. The relevance here is what is the purpose, the primary purpose, and possibly the dominant purpose. So accordingly, with the plain vanilla effect, which I've discussed earlier, those cases will have to be carried out through a company. But when we're outside of the plain vanilla, then the council is able to act perhaps either directly or through a structure such as the LLP in Peters. I've tentatively suggested here, raised the possibility, well, what happens where you're kind of primarily acting in what seems to be a commercial manner, but you've earmarked your profits for a particular social purpose. Is that enough to take us outside the scope of Section 4? This is an untested proposition, but my thoughts are this probably may end up proving too much, because we have to understand the purpose of Section 4, the reason why authorities have to act through companies when they're acting for commercial purposes, is to essentially ensure a level playing field as between the authority's commercial venture and other private entities in the field. So I don't think necessarily the earmarking of profits would be enough to take us out of that field of kind of equal and fair competition. The flip side, however, is that because when one is taking this kind of overall, as I put it, rather than atomized approach to what the authority is actually doing, it's much more difficult then to rely on the general power of competence if one, and outside of a company structure, for kind of filling in the gaps where other statutory powers aren't there. Now, the other implication of this aspect of the judgment is that the authority also, as an alternative, relied on what I've described as a cocktail of other statutory powers. If it was wrong and it was acting for commercial purposes and should have been obliged under the general power of competence to use a company, the authority said, well, it doesn't matter because we have other statutory powers which we could have been using, and those didn't require us to use used the company structure, and I've listed the four on which it relied. Now, Mr. Justice Uzi was a little sceptical as to whether or not these provisions could be relied upon if the council was acting for a commercial purpose. I don't think this is a point on which councils should be too concerned, because it fits in with his overall view of Section 4 and commercial purposes. If you take, as he did, a narrow understanding of what commercial purposes means, i.e. it only applies when the authority's sole or its dominant purpose is to generate profit in a commercial way, it's understandable then, when having found that the authority is acting commercially, it's acting with a dominant way to make profits, that actually it's very difficult then to say it could alternatively do this for pursuant to other statutory powers, which are understandably much more narrow in their scope. So it's, if you've got a power to invest, for example, having made a factual finding that the authority is acting primarily to generate profit, it's much more difficult to act pursuant to a power to develop land and so on. Accordingly, if the commercial purpose doctrine was more widely interpreted than Mr. Justice Ouseley did, the flip side of the coin then would be authorities may then be more entitled to rely on these other cocktail of powers. So I'd like to use my remaining time to talk a little bit about the consultation obligations in Section 3 of the Local Government Act 1999. Now, I've laid this out on the slide in full because this is one of those provisions which is pretty knotty and difficult to understand both by practitioners and by courts and everyone involved, really. There are a number of difficulties in applying the duty under Section 3, and specifically the duty under Section 3.2. The Section 3.1 duty is the best value authority as we know it. And what jumps off the page on Section 3.1 is that the duty here is to make arrangements. And that's what it seems to be. And then we see in Section 3.2 is, for the purposes of deciding how to fulfil that duty, the authority is under a duty to consult. And we see the four categories in subsections A to D as to who must be consulted. So there are three great mysteries of Section 3 on the next slide. But I'm actually going to leave this slide up so you can kind of see them in the context of the statutory provision. So the first of those mysteries is, when does the consultation obligation apply? At which point exactly? The other difficulty, and we can see this quite clearly in Section 3.2d, is who falls into that category of persons appearing to the authority to have an interest in any area within which the authority carries out its functions. It's a very broad category. And finally, generally, why do not too many people take too much notice of this duty? And the answer to that final mystery may perhaps be the lack of statutory guidance on the consultation duty, which is about a page and a half and isn't too illustrative of the duties that authorities are under. So prior to Peters, the key case on Section 3 was that of Nash. Nash, the Section 3.2 consultation duty was considered at first instance in Nash by Lord Justice Underhill. The duty was deemed to be breached both in Nash and in Peters, but in both cases the challenge failed on delay grounds. Now, that point I'll come to shortly in terms of some kind of practical lessons from this, but it's an important one about the time at which the duty is engaged and the difficulties that raises for claimants to subsequently rely upon any potential breaches of the Section 3.2 duty. It's quite telling that in both these two key cases on Section 3, delay was the reason that the case didn't proceed. The Court of Appeal in Nash didn't actually deal with the substance of Lord Justice Underhill's analysis of the content of the Section 3.2 duty. It was dealing only with a delay point, but it did endorse his reasoning, so it stands. So what do we know in relation to the duty to consult under Section 3.2? The first point is, and this is a point which doesn't, as we've seen, jump off the page from the wording, because the wording might suggest that the consultation arises in respect to the making arrangements, because that's what the duty is under Section 3.1. But actually, no, the duty to consult under Section 3.2 actually does extend to the substance of decisions about how to perform those functions. So on the face of it, that would seem to be quite a potentially onerous duty on authorities, But we can see my second bullet point here, which is that the duty relates to the high-level decisions about those arrangements with other parties. So we're talking about the kind of strategic-level decisions, not, one, the implementation of those decisions, the actual particular operational decisions taken by the authority, or what Mr. Justice Ouseley described as matters of improved internal efficiency. So taking the paradigm example of outsourcing, one can see that the decision, the initial strategic decision to outsource might be one to which, or probably would be one to which, the duty attaches, but then subsequent decisions in respect of awarding the contract are more operational and the duty wouldn't apply to those more implementation-related or operational decisions. So in terms of the kind of practical thoughts that we can think about in terms of the duty on Section 3.2, the short line answer is that it's still a bit obscure. The provision isn't tested enough in the courts to lay down some clear lines as to when it does and doesn't apply. So the kind of safe conservative guidance is to take a broad approach and to consult where one can and when one is able to do so. But bearing in mind that isn't too onerous, where the duty is not one of broad public consultation, but rather it's a duty to consult where there are representative arrangements, and that comes off the face of the statute itself. And finally, timing is a key consideration in respect of the Section 3.2 duty. Because the duty attaches to the high level, the initial strategic decision, the consultation has to occur before that decision has been taken. Now, that ends up being a bit of a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, the downside for authorities is that if a duty to consult was then and it was either not undertaken or undertaken in a flawed manner, it's quite difficult to repair those omissions further down the line. But the other way, and this is, I think, probably of greater help to authorities, is that last-minute attempts to kind of derail major projects often come too late, because what's happened is the original duty to consult occurred when the strategic decision was taken. It was either carried out, if it was not carried out, or even if it was carried out but in a flawed manner, a lot of water has gone under the bridge before the operative decision was taken. The JR is brought against the operative decision a number of months later, trying to impugn the lack of or the format of the Section 3.2 consultation, and it's just months and months too late. And that's essentially what we see happening both in Nash and also in Peters. I think that's the end.
Thank you for listening. For more details, please visit 11kbw.com.